Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
You're listening to the Reversing Climate Change podcast by the team at NORI, the carbon removal marketplace. This is a show about the innovators and entrepreneurs developing solutions to climate change.
I'm just regretting not having the tape already turned on to catch that.
I was going to say, that was the important little bit. We're going to have to rewind.
I can always repeat myself. I love to repeat myself.
That's okay. That's part of the ephemerality of podcast. It's gone forever. Listener, you'll never know what we were just talking about. It was fantastic.
I guess you have no way of
independently verifying this statement. But hi, I'm Ross Kenyon. I'm one of the co-founders of NORI. This is the Reversing Climate Change podcast. We talk about carbon removal and things adjacent to it, like climate baking. We have an alumna back on the show, Caroline Saunders. Hello.
Hey,
you actually have one of the most popular episodes ever, because you were the final episode before season break, and people, I think, just listened to the last episode. So you just inherited like windfall. or we have like diehard dessert fans. It's one of the two, and nothing in between. And Radhika Mogalkar is here, host of Carbon Removal Newsroom, NORI's head of supply and methodology, and also a baker. You like to bake? I've had your stuff before.
I do love to bake. I love to bake. In fact, I spent many of my stay-at-home mom days baking, and now I've passed it on to my two daughters, who also love to bake, and hopefully my son, who's the youngest of my three, will join in soon as well. So I don't bake as much anymore, Ross, because my kids always want to bake. So the only time I'm allowed to bake is at Christmas, when they're like, when it's mom's time to bake, because I can only make those desserts the way they like them.
Well, he's too busy being corrupted by me passing him World War II histories.
And then he read that trilogy, by the way.
N.W. Toll, yeah.
The whole trilogy. Now he's moving on to some Civil War history.
Ooh, yeah, we gotta hang out. I think that's all there is to it. Yeah. But yeah, Caroline, we had you on because so much in your life has happened since you were last here. I think you were just about to go to pastry school, right? You were like, this was like your last stop before Paris.
It really was. Yeah. Since we last talked, I've hopped continents. I've unhopped continents. I went to pastry school in Paris, which was super, super fun. I had been living in Seattle. Now I live in New York as of last summer. Working different jobs, doing more baking. The world has shifted in very fun ways.
Yeah, that's pretty exciting, because you were just exploring this intersection of climate and baking, because those were, I'm sure you have many other passions, but those were like two quite prominent ones in your life, because you were a Christie for a long time.
I was in the climate media space. I was working at Grist as chief of staff. And then my like pandemic thing that happened was I decided to put my climate stuff and baking stuff, which I had always been doing just at a home level, together and explore them in the form of a podcast. And it was just a total appetite whetter. I didn't really know what would be there, but I was curious about like, what's going to happen to vanilla? How could we be baking more sustainably, et cetera, et cetera. And so then I went to pastry school in Paris at Le Cordon Bleu, and I had climate change on the mind the whole time. And it has all just sort of exploded from there.
The sad thing is I used my thin blue line joke the first time you were on, and now I don't get to use it again.
As in like the police thing, thin blue line?
But also like Le Cordon Bleu is just like the blue line. No? No? You can say oui, mais non.
Is that what it means? I think it means blue ribbon.
The what?
The Le Cordon Bleu. Doesn't it mean le ribbon blue?
Is it a ribbon? Because I also think of like cordon sanitaire, like keep like a line around something, like a quarantine. I guess it could be.
Well, Ross, your French may be better than mine. I have no idea.
There's zero chance of that. Don't you also speak like Bhutanese or Nepalese or something too?
Nepali, but for a while, I would say it's now completely gone due to my terrible memory.
Zero chance I have any linguistic leg up on you, but okay. You studied pastry in France in French?
Yes. Wow. But there's so much to unpack there and so much to haunt me forever. But yes, I did. It was totally doable for a couple of reasons. The Le Cordon Bleu program, sorry, Brooklyn background noise. I live next to a hospital. The Le Cordon Bleu program is taught in French, but simultaneously translated into English by translators that are there. There are two types of classes, demonstrations in the morning, where you jot down like four or five recipes as the chefs are demoing them. And then you immediately go to practicals. The demos are translated into English. The practicals are not. So you need to have like really prepped and asked any questions, but in theory you can get by without French. I say in theory pretty firmly. I spoke decent French and it got better as I was there, in part because, you know, just immersion of life, but also because one of my partners that I was assigned to for a lot of the year spoke only French. So that'll do it. Learned a lot of vocabulary about kitchens.
Yeah, quite technical vocabulary, I can only imagine.
So many words for spatulas.
Tell us some of the words for spatula. How many?
Well, of course, now none come to mind. So I don't know. These are dark times.
I was hoping you could just rattle off like 15 of them real fast.
I'll pepper them in.
You finished there. I don't know. Did you stodge some places? Did you end up working or did you just come back home afterwards? What happened?
I came straight back. I had in part because, I'll just say that you could like pay more to get the privilege of doing an unpaid internship. And that wasn't totally appealing to my savings account. but I did have friends in the program who stayed and staged or worked in Paris and London. I have a very close friend who's now working in the pastry team at Otto Lange in London. And so I have classmates who took much more legit routes than I did. And wow. I feel so lucky to like know them and be even tangentially in that company now.
Oh my God, their displays are some of the most beautiful.
Just ridiculous, like so cool.
What would I look up to find it? I mean, I have a couple of his cookbooks, but
you just gotta go to London, Ross, and go hang out at one of his shops.
You're so right, Radhika. Like their windowscapes. I don't know, maybe just Google I'm looking at this.
Like big trays of food and
it's like unshakable to be the memories of these like big round meringues speckled with like big raspberry striping, just like crazy stuff.
Wow. Yeah, that's pretty neat. That's cool. So you went a different route though. You said, no, thanks. I don't want to go for the Michelin star intense pastry chef life.
No, I'm truly not strong enough. I did physically. When I got to New York, I wondered, I was a little, I thought I wanted to kind of go into more of a food media direction, cookbooky stuff, writing stuff, recipe testing stuff, but I wanted to be sure. And so I did one stage here at a very cool restaurant in Brooklyn in pastry. And it just confirmed I'm weak of body and mind and decided.
What does that mean? What happened to you? Is it just brutal grind or what?
It's, you know, like restaurant work is just physically demanding. You hear it and it's real. And I was just like, this is so, so cool. And I have so much respect for this, but turns out I do want to be on a laptop part of the day.
It's a crazy combination that you'd have to be like, I love to bake. And then it's like, well, do you like baking when everyone's yelling in a formal sort of brigade environment too? Because that's the only way to do it.
Yeah. Does that also sound appealing in the same breath, I hope?
Yeah. It's weird. Those things get paired and they're sort of tightly linked, at least culturally. It's like one of the dominant forms it expresses itself in, right?
We can probably thank the French for that. They exported the brigade system and all its attendant yellings to most of the world.
Attendant Yellings of Escoffier. That's the name of the book that came from.
That is the name of the book. Yeah. Right. Yeah. That's right. The bio I'll write of him anyway. Wow.
Okay. So you're back in the States. You stodged. Okay. You don't really want to live that life. You want something a little bit nicer, a little softer, maybe. So what's next? What did you do? I've seen some of the, I already know kind of what you did, but I'm like playing dumb. So just tell everyone what you did.
that was so subtle and gentle. Great. Mm-hmm. So I did a mix of things in the fall while I was figuring out what I wanted to do. And as of a few months ago, now with my feet under me in New York, I started a role as a writer in residence with a really interesting climate and culture philanthropy that's trying to essentially support the creation of more like climate and cultural works. And that's helping me kickstart this newsletter project. And then I'm also just beginning to do a little bit of freelancing for different publications on food and climate. And I'm also working as a recipe tester on a baking cookbook. So I'm doing all the things I love. It's really fun.
That seems like a dream job. I feel like did we have this conversation or did I ask someone else? Becoming a recipe tester seems like a dream job for many people. How does this just like fall out of the sky into your lap?
The answer is you slide into people's DMs. That's exactly what I did.
Is that what you did? It's just Twitter?
And I got the idea from another young baker in New York City who just posted, like I follow all these young people trying to get inspiration from them. And God, I say that like I'm an 80-year-old, all these young people. And she had said she did the same thing. She was like, yeah, I like got my start recipe testing just by sliding into people's DMs and like aggressively marketing myself for work. And so I tried it too with the same person that she did and it worked.
What does that look like? Do you have to do just incredibly small variations of the same general recipe? Or
how's you guys, it is as cool as you could possibly picture it being. I can't believe I get to do this as part of my work week. The woman I'm working with, her name is Jessie Sheehan, and she's a really talented baker. Last year, she had a book called Snackable Bakes. It was a really great bestseller. And she is writing the book now on a relatively tight time frame. And so sometimes the recipes I'm handed to test, I'm trying not to say too much because it's all still under wraps, but sometimes the recipes I'm tested are like, just bake it. It's already good, but I just want somebody else to confirm. And sometimes it's more like there's a specific thing we're troubleshooting here. Like this week, we are working on a recipe over and over and over and over again. And so in that instance, it's really cool to see how bakers of this kind of caliber that are developing recipes for home cooks are so committed to the craft and like getting it right. And it's given me a whole new level of appreciation for what happens behind the scenes of a cookbook, because it's just wild. And I'm not the only one. There's multiple recipe testers, people scheming back and forth in Google Docs or texting late last night, like calling in all these experts to fix things. And making a ton of baked goods that I then either consume myself or force onto my roommates.
You have enough of Radek and I, so we cooked the recipes that you sent us, or most of them between us. We cooked all of them between us, but we split them up. It's not that interesting probably to talk about the exact distribution. I'm probably going to trim that down a little bit. but we were wondering, especially on the perennial tart that we baked with some kernza flour, how do you even know how to substitute something like that in? Like, how much of this is chemistry, or how much of this is that you know this is the amount of protein content, it's going to change the crumb like this? Like, to me, it's just magic. Like, how do you, obviously there's some conceptual linkage between these things for you that's probably relatively simple, but for me, it's just like, how could you possibly sub these things out for one another?
Totally. Yeah. And I think, it's all chaos. It's all magic. And pastry school helped to demystify parts of it. But like in the case of something like kernza, it's that much more interesting because it's literally a new crop that hasn't existed before for human consumption. And so there is information about things like protein levels, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm not even that deep into it. And so part of it is working with intuition. But what I'll say about like that recipe, the perennial tart, is that I know with something like kernza that the gluten levels and gluten structure is weaker than in a normal bread flour or AP flour that we might get from the store. And so one of the things that means is that it's not going to rise very well. So cool, I'm going to rule out making anything with it that should be fluffy or really tall. I'm going to go for lower stuff, cookies, bars, tart crusts. And Kernza has, as I've worked with it over the past couple of years, has a very like cinnamony sweet, extremely distinctive flavor. Like anyone who bakes with it, I just actually interviewed a much more talented baker than me who has developed a lot of recipes with it about this. She was like, I really think if people adopt Kernza, it's going to be because this flavor is wild. It's so different. But because it has that cinnamony, spicy, nutty flavor, I immediately thought this particular type of French shortbread, a Brittany shortbread that has a higher fat content that always uses a nut flour, because it's a richer flavor, it has a little bit more moisture than other tart crusts, and it has a nuttiness that others don't. And it just felt like a match made in heaven for a Kernza. So I was like, okay, we're gonna do that. And so then once I had the like general idea, it just took a lot of tinkering, like playing with the moisture. I went through like several recipes of like how much egg yolk should there be? If I'm gonna add a little bit of almond butter, how much is that gonna mess with the moisture? I've been working on that one for a couple years and it still could probably be tweaked.
Is it like moisture and protein? And are those like the main variables that you're really getting down to?
Protein and another thing that comes up with any whole grain flour is the fiber content. So if you're leaving like a normal store-bought flour is mostly endosperm of the kernel. So it's a lot of starch, good amount of protein, but it's typically had the germ and the bran removed for largely shelf life, but also because it's what like American bakers have been conditioned to expect is a fluffier, whiter flour. And so when you're working with a whole grain flour of any kind and it has the bran in it, you're dealing with, shall I say, in a total sales pitch, roughage. And so you have to either like be picking a recipe that that's going to be okay in, or sifting some of it out, or just like aware of it and calibrating accordingly.
One thing I liked about your key lime pie, I did such a terrible job. My crust ended up so gummy. And I think it was because it didn't seem wet enough to cohere when I was putting it into the tray. And then I second guessed myself. I was like, I clearly know better than Caroline, judge of the Cordon Bleu, actually in Paris. And I just like ruined it. And I had to make like a second crust and I turned it into like some sort of crumble disaster. And then I froze it and made it into like a mediocre ice cream. It's just like every step of it just got stupider.
I read this essay about this very phenomenon recently that was like,
I'm basically Tamar Adler, right? Or is that not this is basically the point of Everlasting Meal. I turned one dessert into three bad worst desserts.
Right. There's some kind of, we'll call it a cycle. Is it virtuous? We don't know, but it's a cycle of some kind.
Oh, sorry. What were you going to say though, before I had to say that thing?
Oh, God only knows. Maybe just that, that is one of the harder ones because it's like, there's multiple elements to it. Like working with agar is kind of a pain and a new thing to cook a filling on the stovetop for a key lime pie versus just mixing something together cold. We can get way into that and why I chose that recipe, but acknowledging that it in future versions, it would be nice if it were simpler.
I've only ever seen it on Top Chef basically. And so that was my first time buying it. I had to figure out where in the grocery store I could even find this. And I asked two different people and I didn't know.
Oh, agar. I thought you meant key lime pie. I was like,
yeah, I just bought a key lime pie and ate it. And now I'm here to talk about it on the podcast. And then I ruined it and turned it into bad ice cream. Yeah.
My key lime pie religion has been deeply affected.
And that's like my familial favorite though. Like growing up, my dad, huge key lime pie fan. I still request that on special days is like my baked good of choice. I also like that you identify it as, because a lot of your work strikes me as finding familiar things and trying to like remake them in like a 21st century climate focused kind of way. And I see a lot of trends towards that, like Beast and Cleaver here in Seattle. You know, there are like a lot of butcheries bringing back aspic, bringing back head cheese, bringing back pate, terrine. And I just saw a book come out from the B. Dylan Hollis book, Baking Yesteryear. A lot of it's best recipes from the 1900s to the 1980s. And there's like a desire to like, what have we lost? Or what are some of these old, like used to be hokey, but wouldn't it be fun to make some sort of carrots in jello kind of deal just for fun? Radhika, your head now. Radhika, it's your chance to interject and yell at me.
I don't even know where to go with carrots and jello.
That's the only topic you're allowed to comment on now. Sorry.
That is disgusting. Actually, yeah, I was just like curious how you think about convincing people to change their minds around this. Cause like my husband and I had the perennial tart this morning. We tried it out and you know, it was like a different mindset actually. Cause the crust is different from what we were expecting. Like, calling it one thing wasn't really representative of what it really was. It was very tasty, but it just wasn't what was in our head. So how do you think about like shifting people's mindset around that?
Oh, it's such a good question.
I ask good questions, Ross. Ha!
I invited you here to do that. Okay, yeah, go ahead, Caroline.
it's actually a very good, like, big question that I think about a lot in the project I'm trying to do, of which I would say this newsletter is really just a stepping stone toward. I'm really interested in like regenerative and climate friendly baking and helping to tease that out in the US. I say tease it out because I think a lot of it's already happening. This is just me personally, but I think about it in two ways. Like, if we're going to, it's kind of a different thing for cooking, but let's talk about baking. If we're going to shift the like sweet corner of our cuisine towards something that is more reflective of a better, good, great, wonderful food system, and that hopefully could even be so tasty that it like helps inspire us toward that, I think of like two main things that we need. I think of all the baked goods and foods out there in all sorts of different cuisines all over the world that are already sustainable because they, let's say, unlike French cuisine, are already comfortable using plant-based ingredients to get jiggle in a pudding, in a something else. So I think a lot about like, what might we be eating that is not actually new, just might be new to certain eaters among us. But in that way, there's not exactly a changed flavor threshold that you have to cross. It might, in some cases, just be an introduction to something new and might be very familiar to others. And then I also think, like you were saying earlier, Ross, a lot about like updating Americana classics to use more climate-friendly components. But I think there that the real rub is making versions that are just as tasty or tastier. And that in some cases can be a tall order. It's just something I'm like very personally interested in. I'm really curious about what like a whole gamut of the delicious Southern desserts that I grew up with might taste like if some of them were made with more plant-rich ingredients, if others of them somehow captured like foods that are commonly wasted, if they used a palette of more biodiverse or climate-proof ingredients. And I see a little bit of that work. I don't see a ton of it. And so when I think about the recipes that I feel like I would like to develop, it's those. But there's a really high bar there to like sell the people that are used to the original. And so that's why I'm interested in a pursuit, like trying to get a plant-based key lime pie that tastes just as good. I'll give you my evaluation of that key lime pie. I think it's 90% of the way there. I've tested it like 17 times. It's a fully plant-based key lime pie, which usually gets its squidge, its fat, its flavor, its yumminess from sweetened condensed milk. But in this recipe, gets it from a mix of coconut, cream, tofu, agar agar, ideas I borrowed from different cuisines that already do that. But the reason I think it's not 100% of the way there, and I would love for a baker listening to help figure out how to do this, is add that little bit of richness that is missing from the sweetened condensed milk. And so anyway, that's all just to say, I think there are different ways of like approaching how you make this part of our cuisine more sustainable and regenerative. And some are going to be harder than others. The reinventions are going to be really challenging, but that's the fun.
I'm with you, Radhika, too, that having a common cultural point of reference can be a risk too, because if you eat it and it's not what you expect, you're like, the worst thing about vegan food is definitely when it tries to be something it's not, and then you're like, this is way worse. Just be like intentionally different and diverge from meat as the standard center of the plate, and it's fine. But did you ever go to Frankie and Joe's when you were here in Seattle?
Yeah.
It's all like coconut cream based, or it's coconut based ice cream. I took my parents there. My parents, not vegans, liable to make fun of vegans. Wouldn't have known if I didn't tell them, and they were very happy. And then it was fun to spring it on them, be like, surprise.
Oh, good. That's the opposite of what I thought you were going to say. Okay, good.
No, I think I can go toe to toe with like really great milk-based ice cream. And that's mm-hmm. really the dream, I think.
Totally. And they have some wacky ones too. The charcoal, the like pine.
I like they focus on plant-based ingredients, but that's a different kind of project than saying, what if I baked with regenerative ingredients that were animal based? Because I think in general it's probably more it's the how, not the cow, as the line goes. So like if you were using like nice like pasture raised dairy cow milk, is that a project that's valuable to you, or are you trying to, that's just not a big enough statement maybe?
No, that's a very valid point. I'll answer that by saying, like, part of what I'm interested in doing as I keep like going deeper into this newsletter project is building out a rubric in my mind scientifically of what regenerative and climate friendly baking means. And I'll tell you my work in progress rubric, but I'm like actively trying to talk to scientists every single week to like make it stronger. Wow. I'm interested in a set of pointers you could give home bakers that provide different types of entry points into baking regeneratively, because I'm not an all or nothing person. I just think it's more useful from a social change perspective to give people toeholds. Like that's what works for me. So how can I ask differently of other people? And so I think about things like using more plant-rich ingredients, think about, reducing waste as much as we can, because those two are the biggest climate mitigation things you hear, of course, but then also really interested in a palette of ingredients that, like I mentioned, is climate proof, leaning into biodiversity, but then also better sourcing, like you're saying. And so totally, totally valid to be using better sourced dairy, eggs, et cetera, of course. And I like the sort of mantra that's commonly talked about in food circles, that's like, we probably just should be thinking of animal products more as a treat and sourcing them better when we use them on a more sparing basis. That's in theory what I try to do.
So how do you think about like accessibility? You know, I think one of the hardest things is sort of sometimes getting to the ingredients, some of the more like agar and other types of ingredients that maybe we are lucky enough to have in Seattle and New York, but not so much in the middle of the country. And so, you know, as you build out a fan base, what's your advice going to be to them to get like some of these maybe harder to access ingredients?
Totally. I think what I'd like to build toward is striking a balance of having a bunch of approachable recipes that use simpler ingredients that are readily available. The cool thing is that there's so much plant-based baking already happening in the US that does just that, that makes really simple plant-based cookies and all that stuff. I would really like to highlight. And then moving toward a proportion of more like sprinkling in the harder to source stuff. But I think as I've started this in the past 2 months, I've probably erred on the side of the more specific outlandish stuff that I already knew about or was trained on in pastry school, like agar. So I'm trying to like chill out.
I don't think you've even named the newsletter here, the project. Did you even tell people what it is?
Maybe I didn't. It's called Pale Blue Tart, which is a riff, for those who don't get it, on Pale Blue Dot, which is how Carl Sagan described tiny little Earth as seen from space. And the tagline is documenting and dreaming up a dessert menu for the climate era. Emphasis on documenting, intentional, because I want to be like, I'm hoping that what it becomes over time is a split of like telling stories about this more sustainable baking that's already unfolding, and a fair amount of instruction and how to participate, whether that's ingredient guides or actual recipes sourced from chefs or occasionally from me.
You're saying you were just at a conference where many of the quite prominent presenters and bakers were talking about climate, and that was almost like the first thing that they were talking about.
I sat down at one workshop on rye breads on the second day of this really cool conference called the Kneading Conference. I'm wearing their pretzel t-shirt right now. I sat down at this workshop that Nora Allen, who is a James Beard nominated baker behind the bakery, Melda Baker in New York. She was teaching a workshop on rye breads, and she opened this workshop by saying, "We have to start by talking about the climate." And I was like, wow, that is on the nose for what I was hoping to find here. And there were other bakers who were talking about the importance of seed saving and preserving old varieties of seeds in Maine to strengthen the resilience of the food system. They're turning them into arepas at different restaurants. People talking about arid grains in Phoenix and what it might look like to feed Phoenix sustainably in 100 years, a complicated question that we were exploring through the lens of handmade pasta in that instance. But yeah, it was really cool. I think that there are just an increasing number of connections being made between climate and baking by the people that do baking and pastry. And probably in part because people who work in food are just close to the land and farming and what's happening there, but also probably just because of the atmosphere that we're in. Everyone's talking about climate more and more. Heat, like, holy wow. Yeah, it's just more everywhere than ever.
Here it's pretty sweaty there right now.
Yeah, it's better this week, but it was a sweat fest the last month.
So did you see that same interest in France? Were they talking about smart baking?
No. And I was often the annoying student in these like 90 little bright-eyed / sleepy 18-year-old French kids. I was the one always raising my hand and asking questions about languages to sustainability and farming and yada, yada, yada. I think Le Cordon Bleu is a really cool and interesting program. And I think they teach the craft really well. But I get the sense that there's an industry-wide thing at culinary schools of not making a whole ton of linkages between sustainability and food, at least in France. I can't really speak to what's happening at U.S. culinary schools. But there wasn't a single word about sustainability and climate change. In a context where we were talking a lot often about things like biodiversity of lemons across the globe, or you know, economic changes in the price of grain. Like these, we were talking about lots of really interesting cultural and economic aspects of context for pastry and baking, but not climate. And I was just sometimes kind of seething because there are people making the connections, and I was like, they should be teaching classes on it.
But maybe it's because the French are so protective of their culture, right? I mean, they have a different, it feels like a different viewpoint sometimes on changes to their language, changes to their culture. They're much more much more regimented than maybe the UK or the US is around those perspectives. That's both what I learned in my French class and observed when I was over there. You know, it was just, they're protective and probably don't like the change.
Yeah, I think that's quite possible is what I will say.
Other aspects of the curriculum have surely changed in preceding decades. Or do you feel like it actually is intentionally a throwback? This is like classical French pastry, don't mess with it.
Well, there is an aspect of that. And I mean, I say that with like love and respect it, to a certain extent. It is a program that is all about the classics of French pastry. And that was really, really cool. I got serious foundations. I still have my textbooks with me in like Dequoise in Napoleon's. We spent weeks and weeks on different types of tarts and the varieties.
How's your milfoy? Pretty good?
My milfoy was okay.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
Never develop a milfoy recipe. Yeah, it's, you know, like, I hope I don't offend any French listeners, but it's a culture, it seems like, certainly a food culture that traditionally is a little bit more backward looking and is about preserving. And there's real cool value in that, but it's also not really geared toward change and evolution so much. It's not something they seem to do comfortably, particularly in culinary schools.
Sometimes being protective and conservative of your food ways can be a good climate move too. I think of like, you like Dan Saladino's stuff, right? Did you read Eating to Extinction?
Yeah.
Yeah, like preserving those like dying food ways is good for the climate. It's good for culture. It's kind of good for everything. But
totally.
But maybe if you locked in the like post-war conventional ag food system model, that's probably being conservative in a not so good way.
Well, I think that's such an interesting point because a lot of what's now like just familiar and accepted in pastry across the world actually comes from a palette of ingredients that is pretty recent. So we're dedicated to a system of food traditions that have only been that way for what, 150 years, 100?
Like what? Explain that. That's an interesting idea.
White flour, sugar. I don't know as much about sugar, but let's talk white flour. Like, I've heard stats that in the late 1800s, early 1900s, there were like tens of thousands of flour mills across the United States, across Europe too. And those have been consolidated down to way, way, way fewer. I don't want to throw out a number because I can't remember, but not many. And, you know, the refining of flour was this process that evolved for a bunch of reasons, primarily to extend shelf life, but also to create a finer, softer flavor. And then the American consumer palate got really used to that fast. Traditions of fluffy loaf cakes sprung up, or fluffy layer cakes, I should say. And we have gotten really used to those types of flavors and textures that lack a lot in terms of the nutrition that would have been inherent to those ingredients a century before that. And a lot of the flavor complexity, like with white flour, we've gotten used to serious neutrality. And I'm not really like hardcore 100% dissing it. I use it all the time. I use it many times a week. I love it. If I make a birthday cake with it, of course I'm using white flour, but I'm really interested in how we start to just adjust those dials and ask those questions. Like there are really famous, interesting bakers right now, like Natasha Pickowitz, who just published a book called More Than Cake, asking questions about and getting recipes for how could we spike birthday cakes and layer cakes with whole grains in a way that adds flavor without messing with texture. And those are the like culinary questions that I'm really interested in how makers of food drive forward in answer to these agricultural environmental questions that farmers, policymakers, scientists, et cetera, are doing in their part of the equation.
Those questions interest you, Radhika, in your baking, or are you taking your climate hat off at that time and you just want to enjoy your kitchen time?
I mean, I'm interested in them. I will say, like, I'm a little bit of a skeptic, not of the vision, but of like the unintended consequences, because whenever I look at a historical record, I don't think human choice was made with the intent of making things worse. And so as we like go down these different paths, I wonder where we're going to end up. But I am curious, and I like, you know, I've got an Indian background. So of course some of my taste buds are different. And it was when I was in Vietnam over our Christmas break, you know, it was an interesting conversation to have it with the food people there, because they were talking about the Vietnamese palate and their ability to deal with other types of like crunch and texture that like an American palate just can't get into. And so that kind of interests me as well. Like it's beyond just the flavor profile, but it's also the textural areas of eating and And also the memories associated with them. I mean, Carolyn mentioned like her Southern roots, right? Southern folks are very tied to like the certain way of making stuff. And, you know, I'm tied to certain things too. And so how do you, again, change the mindset around that? And, you know, when my kids grow up, they're going to say, my mom made this and she always made it this way. And you can't change it because that's what my memories of childhood are associated with. So I think it's a really interesting, just social question.
Yeah,
but honestly, yeah. I don't have a ton of time to experiment. So I'm just looking for people to tell me to do how to do it well, because, you know, if I'm going to make something, I want it to be a success. So I need good recipes.
Yeah. Yeah. You're right. It's a really, really interesting social question. And like, I think my bias in the way I think about answering it is like to just say flavor, like, you know, people, I just feel like people are not gonna, eat all that differently, at least when it comes to dessert, which is just so much about like hedonism and enjoyment and comfort and connecting over something with others and love. I feel like with dessert, you're not going to make that many compromises for the sake of a sense of moral obligation or environmental civic duty or whatever the heck. And so that to me is like the complexity and fun of the project. And I'm not talking about my newsletter anymore. I'm talking about like the work of chefs and bakers.
I was just going to say, you know, another piece of this, which is sort of tangential, but the food history kind of aspect too is really interesting to me. And like Stella Parks, right, wrote a cookbook a few years ago, which like was a historical categorization. So I'm going to be curious to see as we evolve in this space, how the historical pulp plays out and what it looks like and how we do combine kind of this moment of environmental need with the past that brings so much.
There's always so much to learn from the past, and to forget that is just like folly and to waste time and also hubris and all the things. I talked to, I love Stella Parks. I talked to another cake historian, Anne Byrne, a couple of years ago for my podcast. We talked about things like, you know, depression cakes and reducing food waste and turning vegetables that have sweetness into a cake ingredient. Sauerkraut chocolate cakes, you know, there's this whole like panoply and like rich menus of cakes made with leftovers, cakes made with the barest of pantry ingredients. And all of those to me just like assemble themselves in a happy little baking zipper of like low waste recipes that are stuff we should be pulling on from our wise ancestors and the people around us that are doing stuff like that in the now. I would love to see a like baking cookbook one day that is about climate and regenerative stuff, perhaps not surprisingly, that does that sort of representative pulling of like some stuff that exists today, some stuff from yesteryear, and that assembles itself into a happy thing that's not so hard to create because we have a lot of it.
You're obviously angling for that with this new project of yours. I'm sure you can shop that around town. Like, why wouldn't you? Like, it should be you.
Yeah, I mean, I see the...
And Ross will be your recipe tester because he wants to try all these things.
I will follow your instructions and I will interpret them in the most Amelia Bedelia way so that I ruin everything. And then
I have to send you this Guardian article I was reading that excerpted an essay that was talking about the hilariousness of like this, just this tendency to not follow recipes and how it just like everything one cooks and bakes tends toward sameness and disaster, like the same mistakes we always make. None of us can follow a recipe, including me. I'm like, I surely know better than this like cook who has developed this thing and then I make a terrible dinner, which is what happens every night of the week.
You know, I am the character in the menu who knows a lot about food, but is not really that good at making it. And so he has to make that like horrible, does he make that like horrible braise that Ralph Yens is like, this is shit.
I couldn't watch that. My roommate was watching it, and I just saw the really upsetting stuff of the dude plopping into the water, and I was like, I'm good.
You're good.
I'm kind of Ross, you haven't learned from aunties and stuff. That is the problem. Like,
no. Yeah.
You need that. Like, my husband is like wanted to learn how to cook Indian food when we were first married, and so like he'd go to my different aunties and be like, can you cook this for me? And they would, and he'd have like, he'd literally stick a tablespoon or a teaspoon under as they're like just dumping salt and so, you know, spices in. But there's something inherent in the way they, you just learn it when you live with them and you're interested in it. And I was like, who needs to measure? Apparently you need to measure, but no, you don't.
I'm jealous.
You need some aunties to teach you.
Yeah. Round me up some aunties. That's your new assignment. I have kind of an intense question for you, Caroline. You ready?
Yeah, I guess.
Okay. I don't know if you've ever listened to people in the functional medicine scene, like Mark Hyman and people like that, but they don't think we should be eating this stuff like at all. We shouldn't be eating flour. We should be eating sugar, refined sugar. This is essentially poison. It's all inflammatory. So in some ways, like, they would probably view your project, even if they were serious about climate change, as rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic kind of deal.
Yeah. With full logic, I get it. Should we be eating these things? No. I mean, this is the question I think about a lot, because I've essentially chosen to make a big part of my profession working with sugar and like sweet, terrible stuff. Yeah. And so it becomes a big part of my diet when I'm professionally working on it. So this is on my mind weekly. I'm very conscious, like, what I consume and how much of my baked goods I'm actually consuming. So should we be eating a ton of dessert? No, of course not. But will we? Will I? Yes. I'm much less interested in like, how do I explain this? For me, like when you ask why you would bother making a like regenerative or climate friendly like dessert menu, it's less about like zeroing out emissions the way it is with like a dinner menu, because right, like the worst offenders are on our dinner menu. So I'm not over here fully trying to advocate for like a zero emissions, zero waste dessert menu. I'm much more interested in dessert's power to inspire us toward a sustainable, interesting, regenerative food system, because dessert is attention grabbing. I'm kind of sideways answering your question by saying, like, I think dessert is here to stay. And for people that want to be healthier, cool, great, good for you. You should. I'm going to keep eating dessert and I'm going to try to, like, I just think it has an interesting potential role to play as like a sort of a poster for what could be, because it's such a meme. It's such a source of joy. And yes, it should be enjoyed in moderation.
Was that the meanest question you've ever been asked? That was kind of a, like a surprise, deal with this conceptual challenge.
No, it's a reasonable question. And like I said, yeah, it's always on my mind. I was like, because of the baked goods I'm testing this week, my literal thought today, every hour on the hour, was, when, my God, will I eat a vegetable? And the answer is tomorrow.
Wow. What do we do with recipes? Like, we both made the granita, which is, I mean, come on, what's better? Summer, it's so easy to prep. It's just fruit blended, citrus, get some acid in there, some sugar.
Yeah. Shout out to Stavoshnik. That was her recipe. Great cookbook.
I was wondering, when I make stuff like that, how much of the sugar can I cut out before I'm really going to be sorry for it? Because I don't want to add ever more than I need. So, okay, you're rolling your head back. Are you thinking about this?
No, it's such a good question. And I wish I knew more about the sugar science. It's different proportions. Here's what I remember from a pastry lecture I probably slept through, because they started before 7 many times. And I had to get up at 5 in Paris. Dear God. I know that the sugar level is required to like get the right texture and stuff is different in ice cream, is different in sorbet, is different in gelato, but I can't remember what they are. I guess I'll send out a newsletter on that eventually once I ask someone who knows.
Don't mess with the chemistry, Ross.
Yeah, I mean, that's like, that is the question. Like, am I just going to ruin this thing? So I'm like trying to make it healthy, but should I just like, is that the wrong place to optimize for health? Should I just enjoy the thing?
Yeah, don't make a carnita if you want to optimize for health.
Is it bad for the audio if I stand up and grab a cookbook? Because
it's dynamic.
There's a cookbook here that I'm holding called Good and Sweet by Brian Levy that is all about baking with natural sugars. There are some, I think there's like date syrup in here. There's various those types of sweeteners. But if he also sweetens things with freeze-dried fruits. He sweetens things with whole dates. He sweetens things with, in some cases, apples and chestnut flour alone.
Interesting.
And he has a bunch of recipes for frozen things like ice creams, et cetera, et cetera. And so I'm really interested in that. Sugar is something I haven't tackled yet, because when I write about it, I would like to write about its history, which is extraordinarily complicated and tied to the slave trade.
Not a nice one. Yeah.
Yeah. And I would want to like do it justice, but I'm also really interested in like, he's like fairly singular in coming up with ways to bake without refined sugars that are really, really good. And I think that could be really interesting to talk about. How could part of the regenerative sweet foodscape we dream of be one that is less health harmful? So Mark Hyman, we're working on it.
We have to wrap here soon. Let's tell people how to follow what you're doing. Give them a taste of what's coming soon. And yeah, hopefully they can all go subscribe, start cooking Caroline's great desserts, start baking.
Yeah, would love that. So I'm on Substack with a newsletter called Pale Blue Tart. And you can follow me on Instagram at also Pale Blue Tart, not complicated. And yeah, would love to have you guys subscribe and bake all the things.
Well, thanks for being here. Thanks for answering all of our questions. Radhika, thanks for hanging out too as Nori's chief baker.
Anytime, Ross. I love my new title. I get a C-suite title for being a baker.
I love it.
Well, I thought I had the silliest job of all here doing creative things, but yeah, having a C-suite baker. Yeah, it's extreme.
That's the real dream. Yep.
The real dream. Yeah. Okay.
Thank you so much for listening. If you could please subscribe and give us a great rating and review on Apple Podcasts or a rating on Spotify, that'd be much appreciated. It helps us get our content out to more people. You can sign up for our newsletter at nori.com. Follow us on social media, and we will catch you next time.